From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in storied Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development. I'm Ellen Burns-Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy, I too make nice games.
In this episode, we talk with Anna Webster, lead writer of The Foglands, to discuss writing for games. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start. Thank you for showing us your cat, Anna.
You are so very welcome.
It's really bringing the energy up for the show.
Yeah. Let's go.
Listeners won't see the cat, although you can send us a picture.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah.
But it's an important pre-show thing. When there is a cat available, we'd like to see it.
Mm-hmm. Or any sort of pet, really.
Yeah.
So, Anna, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. Can you do a little introduction?
So, hello. I'm Anna C. Webster. I'm a writer and a narrative designer for games. So, I actually totally never expected to be a game developer my entire life. I was in the performing arts. I even went to opera school at university for a year. And then cool. I was like, I don't know about this, actually. And I got an English degree instead. And now I write video games. So I am the lead writer on The Foglands, which is an upcoming anti-Western roguelike. We're very, very excited about it. And yeah, I have a really fluffy cat named Montezuma, who you all saw. So
still a great name for a cat.
It's a really fantastic
name
for a cat.
Thank you.
I know this anti-Western is a genre that you guys are defining, right? Marie, you've talked to me about this a little bit before. So before we get really into it, give us a little bit of a brief on that, because I'm quite curious.
Sure. So an anti-Western, we're not necessarily defining it. This is a genre that's kind of been out in various spaces for a while, often with indigenous creators. It's kind of this idea that the Western is a really classically American genre, right? It's a genre about tension. It's a genre about people who have fundamentally different worldviews in a hostile environment, essentially. Mm-hmm. But the anti-Western genre is kind of like, hey guys, cowboys are fun and kind of cool, but actually, what if this genre is built on a lot of horrific stuff and has been mostly commandeered by cisgender white men creators? Maybe we need to do better. So a lot of the genre of the anti-Western is about tenets of returning the narrative of the Old West to the people who were actually there, indigenous creators or people who were, I guess now they would be considered, because a large part of the West was owned by Mexico, so they would be considered Mexican or Hispanic. And then also, there were a lot of cowboys who were Black or African American. So that's also a very important part of the genre. So the anti-Western is kind of looking at the colonial setting of the Western and going, all right, how do we fight this? How do we basically sort of turn the genre in on itself? The Western is all about people with different cares fighting each other. So it's actually the pinnacle of the Western genre to have the Western fight the Western.
Interesting.
It's kind of it's an emerging thing. I've learned so much, myself, I am, a white woman, and I've learned so much about this particular genre throughout the work on this project and with our collaborators who are indigenous, and it's been really cool. We're really excited about this game.
Yeah, that's really neat.
And games in particular are so, they lean into tropes so hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's true of all types of media, but I think games are sort of uniquely tied to that familiar structures of narrative.
Yeah.
And so it is, I mean, this is my segue into really what makes games different. And the challenge that you have in particular with this type of thing and writing something that is unexpected or might challenge a player, and you're not always trying to challenge the player with it. You're trying to challenge the genre, right? But what, I guess that's the question. What makes games writing different than sort of, I don't know, writing anything else?
Yeah. There's so many things. The core sort of thing that I often go back to is the element of interactivity.
Yeah.
When you're writing for screen or for stage or even a book, you are expecting the person engaging with the media, your player or your reader, to be there and sort of watching the events unfold. But in games, you literally have to think of your audience member as an active participant in the story. Mm-hmm. So that element of interactivity, like there's all kinds of debates about like how games want to try to be movies sometimes. You know, like they kind of want that like Hollywood sort of feel, and it's like, okay, guys. But if anything, I feel like games are actually much more akin to like interactive theater.
I was going to say.
They're just interactive theater. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, they're much more akin to like a Sheer Madness or a Tina and Tony's Wedding or like those kinds of shows where something is happening and you as the audience member are expected to participate in the events unfolding. So that's like an extra dimension. So you already have to think about all the stuff you write, you know, your characters, your plot structure, the themes, all that kind of stuff that you would with any other genre. But there's this added dimension of interactivity mm-hmm. that you constantly have to think of. That also is a fantastic opportunity because it allows the stories that you tell to be really engaging and people feel really connected to them through games. So it's an extra challenge, but I think that the reward is like definitely worth it. Otherwise, you know, I wouldn't be doing this job.
I am not a writer. Well, I'm a writer in that like I can write words, but I am not a writer in that like I get paid to do this for good reason. And so what I find really interesting and frankly challenging about the idea of writing for games is that the player is the, you know, there is an interactive aspect in it. They're the one, they're a participant. They are participating in the game, and they can ruin your story as a result. Maybe?
Right, isn't the player the writer, sort of?
Yeah.
The relationship you have with that,
right,
that
right.
co-author.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it, so it's like a weird, I guess it's like a weird relationship. The way that I like to think of games is like, I like to think of it as communication, effectively. Specifically, the developer is communicating with the player, and the player is communicating with the developer in a weird, mismatched, separate times space thing. But like I find that to be really fascinating, and I'm curious if you see that when you're writing for a game, do you feel that, and can you like channel that into something? There's a whole lot of words that I don't know how much made sense.
I got you. No, okay, this is actually a thing that like we think about in the process. You know, it's kind of like I think sometimes people see it almost as like, you know, you're like DM or GM in a like tabletop where it's like, oh, you can do anything. Well, the thing about like with games is that you usually have a set of actions that a player can take. Mm-hmm. And usually when going into it, especially if like your game is like really reactive, before I wrote for The Foglands, I wrote for Bloodlines 2. And so there was kind of this element of, you have to figure out, okay, what are the options we are allowing the player to take, and what options should like never be on the table. So like with Bloodlines 2, it was like we wanted the player to like, you know, you're a vampire. You can be a horrible person if you want. Like you can be really mean and obnoxious if you want. That's fine. But at the same time, it's like there are certain things that we never want the player to be mean about, you know, that kind of thing. You make these kinds of decisions. Usually like gameplay is tied in. So like what your core actions are, maybe you can ask questions, maybe you can, get quests, maybe you can, and subsequently you have to be able to return a quest, that sort of thing. So you decide what the player can do. But you also have to keep in mind, like, what sort of things should the player not be able to do, partially because like scope just absolutely balloons out of control. If you don't have those things, like wild. So you do need to sort of have a good sense of that when you go into actually production of the game. So that's usually like a really early pre-pro decision. And usually stuff like UI and gameplay loops and like all of that comes into effect with that to help communicate to the player, hey, here are your actions. Here's what you can do in this game. And here's like, those are basically that's your menu. Those are your choices. This is what you can order off of, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of what we do.
Like, cause some players will want to be like, I'm going to embody this character I'm playing. And so that they do a little role playing, even if the game is not asking them to do that necessarily. And then some players are like, this is me putting on this person's outfit.
Yeah.
So I'm going to just be me.
Yeah.
And so, and you're going to get both types of players, right? So you need a system that can accommodate both. And
Exactly.
And in sort of a marketability sense, satisfy both. But maybe sometimes you are catering to one or the other, but you want the other one along for the ride, maybe? I don't know. It seems like more a logistical challenge than even a writing challenge in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it really is. And so much of it also has to do with production and scope and like, what can we accommodate in the development time that we have? That's a huge one. So like, you know, if you're making a giant RPG, you might have to cut a certain element. If you're like, we just don't have time to write all of those lines, or we don't have time to build in like a stealth path for like this mission. Like that's games, baby, you know, like stuff has to get cut in order to accommodate for the time that you do have, in production. So, a lot of writing for games is also being able to kind of turn on a dime, and shift what you're doing, to still try to accommodate production schedules and the original vision of the product itself. Yeah.
Oh gosh, writing is hard. Oh,
we bring on guests so that Steven knows not to go outside his comfort zone. I think he gets real scared.
It's not hard to make me feel that way.
That sounds fun. You keep doing that. I'm going to stay over here.
Yeah, that's valid. Oh, okay.
I mean, that's not really the goal here on Nice Games Club.
Right, you listener, you definitely can do this. I'm just going to acknowledge that you can do it so I don't have to.
Well, seriously, though, there is something to be said about, like, it's important to understand another discipline, even if it's not for you.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Well, yeah. I mean, I use some of this understanding skills to communicate with our narrative designer and writer, too.
Yeah.
Because, it is important. It's a very valuable thing. Like you mentioned earlier, like, you have to change things based off of, you know, scope and things like that. If during the iterative process of, I guess, everybody else's iteration, how are you approaching the writing in the script based off of what has changed?
That is the art of it. That is the art of it. So a lot of it will kind of vary project to project, right? Like, there's so much of it is going to depend on the actual production. So usually, you know, you've got a certain amount set up in like pre-production. You're like, all right, here's our themes, here's our characters, here's like the stuff that we really don't anticipate is going to change. Put a little asterisk next to that. It may still change. Like, that's just kind of the nature of it. So you have to just be very flexible. And as the iterative process continues, other departments are going to start bringing their own stuff online. What I found is the most useful is having regular narrative reviews. So like, as more things come online and as more elements of the story are actually physically written, see how those work together, right? Like, see, how does it feel? Like, I always joke, you can really tell that I'm like a game writer, narrative designer with a theater background, because I'm always like, well, how does that feel? How does it feel? You know, which is like the most like narrative designer question or the saying you could possibly have.
Yeah.
It's really tricky. The answer is that it's really hard. And sometimes it works really well. And sometimes it doesn't work very well. And you end up with people who have to like change a major feature that they built, or the writers have to suddenly like drop something that they are working on in order to accommodate a certain, like something else.
Yeah.
It's just very flexible. That's why like communication and regular reviews is like, it has to be your bread and butter of production, or it's going to be chaos, you know?
Yeah.
It's very tricky. Yeah.
What happens in that impasse, right? It's like, okay, this structure isn't working with this part of the story, which we've already decided and agreed upon. So now we have two things we like. We can't have both. What is that discussion like? I mean, is it just you feel it out? Is there a creative director who just, it has to be put on their shoulders to decide, or?
It kind of depends on each studio, probably operates a little bit differently in that scenario. In my experience, and this again is because I have a theater background, I'm usually like, okay, let's get everyone in the same room. That's like my normal approach to it is like, okay, we've got this situation here. Let's pull everyone in the same room and let's look at our two things that we've got that we both like. And we also might have like a director there who might officially have like the final say. Like sometimes it might be, okay, we really like both of these things. Usually the actual conversation is about finding what about those things that you really like. Mm-hmm. And then if you have these two things that both people like maybe it's a design thing and maybe it's like a story thing that just don't seem to like really match each other well, it's like, okay, what about each of those things do we really enjoy that feels really fulfilling? Maybe it's really satisfying. And then finding like, quote, like that third thing of like what can work together.
What's
and
the bridge?
Often, yeah, like often in my experience, getting everyone in the same room and literally just talking it out with like, I mean, the biggest thing is like people are really proud of what they've built and what they've written. Mm-hmm. And like, I get that. People want, they want their thing to like outlast it and like win, you know, but it's not about winning, you know, it's about finding what works. So I'm a big fan of the, like, let's get everyone in the same room together and like talk it out scenario. But of course every studio is going to be different, right? Some might be like, okay, well, we take this to the director level and the directors make the decision and we just then make whatever the directors say.
Yeah.
I'm really lucky in that I work at a small company, so we can do the everyone in the room thing like a lot. Yeah. It's really easy for us to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I imagine it's different based on your size.
That makes sense, right? And especially if you're a small company and you're a small, you know, development team, the more you do that, the more practiced you are at having those conversations. And the more, I think, quickly and efficiently you can come to decisions. And maybe the more enjoyable it could be, right? Because if you're working, if you're in a room with a bunch of people you haven't worked with together a lot, it can be a little bit stressful.
And you can feel siloed off after a while, you know, if you're working on something for 2 weeks and you haven't talked to anyone about it.
That
can feel bad too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, something satisfying too about sharing ownership over the finding that third thing.
Yeah.
Like even just being in the room, it's like, well, they got rid of two-thirds of the stuff that I did, but I was part of the solution, and so I don't feel, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not just about making the work better, it's about making the working better.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's a big component as well as in like preventing burnout too.
Yeah.
Like burnout happens because people feel like they aren't appreciated and compensated fairly. So like if you are able to get everyone in the same room and say, okay, like we have these two things here we really like. We don't want to scrap one of them. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We want to find that third thing, if at all possible. Like everyone's contributions are meaningful. That's just also, I used to work at a summer camp. I was a camp counselor. If you can't tell from, like my approach to everything. That's just, that's how I approach it.
Do you start those meetings with, okay, campers?
Okay, campers.
Or like a song to get everyone hyped.
Yeah.
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 Get out the nylon string guitar.
Oh, no.
Oh my gosh. I should though. I am wearing tie dye right now though,
yeah, so. Yeah. In the spirit.
I'm a caricature. It's fine.
So we're kind of on a process line of thinking right now. So I have a couple more questions about that. You had mentioned, you know, like doing regular narrative reviews is really important, especially as additional departments come online. I'm curious, you know, if you think of it kind of like a series of departments coming online. Who comes online before narrative? Or is that like one of the things you should really start with, in your opinion?
I think there's kind of two schools of thought on this. There are people who are like, quote unquote, like design first. Mm-hmm. And there are people who are like story first.
Mm.
And I don't know. I'm not one for like those strong, like two opposing forces thing. I'm a big believer that you have to build the design and the story simultaneously. So usually narrative is one of the first things to come online because often the narrative will inform the design, but the design will also inform the narrative.
Yeah.
So it's usually like design and narrative are like usually some of the first people like in the room. And then there's usually also like engineering who might be like, guys, we can't do that. You know, like, right.
Yeah.
We love you guys. We love you guys. Aww.
To be like on your business card, it's like, I'm from engineering, and a little quote on there, guys, we can't do that.
Yeah. That's good.
No, actually, no. Some of my favorite creative decisions for like story or design problems have literally come from like engineers or programmers. Like, it's a big myth that you guys like aren't the like quote unquote creative types. Just throwing that out there.
Programming is creative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's that everybody in the room kind of thing, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's,
yeah.
Yeah. It's, and that's why we talk about this when we talk about playtesting. It's, mm-hmm. It doesn't really matter. Like, expertise is important for like doing the work, but yeah. it's not a door you're stuck behind.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the ideas can come from anywhere. Solutions come from anywhere, especially something as multidisciplinary. It's like, there's no expertise in, yeah. in combining these seven things in this particular way.
Right.
No one's ever been an expert in that. So mm-hmm. everybody is free to, everyone's as good as anyone else in coming up with a way to make that work. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a good way of phrasing it.
So I have a question about pushing and pulling information. This is something I run into with some of the games that I've worked on, and a lot of the narratives that we, my company works with, are actually very client driven. So they'll come mm-hmm. and be like, okay, we want a story where something like this happens, and then we have to work with them to figure out exactly what the details are at each, you know, turn of the plot, because we're trying to depict some sort of real process, and hopefully people learn yeah. from that. Anyway, so one of the things I've tried to do is create easy to use documentation, diagrams, and things like that, so that this wide variety of people from different parts of my own company, which is figuring its stuff out, and also different parts of the client's company who might be bringing things on, they can look at that clear documentation and get a sense of the story and also the design and how they fit together. Because otherwise, I'm having to have so many meetings where I'm walking everybody through it, you know, or I try to record it and I say, watch the recording, and they're like, well, I don't get it. So I'm wondering, you know, what you think about in terms of the balance of creating information kind of repositories and resources that other parts of the team can pull from versus having meetings and, you know, for example, those narrative reviews where you're more pushing information out on the rest of the team that they need to know. How do you think about that?
Yeah, there's a really like fine balance that has to be struck. I feel like, you know, in that scenario, it's tough. A lot of the typical processes of building a story is that there is some typical repository documents that like a narrative department would have. Mm-hmm. So these can be things like, they're sometimes called story Bibles. I often opt for story codex instead, some people have like a narrative, like one pager, to sort of basically literally give people the absolute most condensed version of the story possible. Mm-hmm. Character briefs are really important. You can even condense that into a single document. That's great for showing to like stakeholders, especially if they need to like, have context for a scene or a story moment. There's stuff like that, that usually a narrative department in pre-production would build. And these things are, they are definitely considered living documents, right? Pretty much everything we write is a living document, but these things are general pillars that can help other departments figure out like, okay, here's what our world looks like. Here's what our characters look like. Here are our themes. And that can really help. And the other thing is, as you said, like they have to be really short. Right.
Yeah.
Because like everyone has so much to do.
Yeah.
And it's like we writers, you know, we might love going into these details of like everything, every character, every like we love that kind of stuff. But at the same time, in our like informational documents, we have to be brief because time is at a premium, mm-hmm. you know? So those are a really good resource. But also you do have to do more of like the quote unquote, like pushing of the content, right? Where you're like, hey, here's what we've got. We really want feedback on this, in reviews and stuff like that, because, you have to have communication going to narrative and from narrative mm-hmm. at all times. If, you know, all departments really,
yeah.
if any of those directions break, it's chaos,
yeah.
you know? So, you do have to strike a really fine balance with that. And that's tricky.
Mm-hmm. Oh man.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's good to know that it's tricky for you, because it's tricky for me.
Yeah.
So now I feel a little reassured that it's just tricky.
Yeah.
No, it's just tricky. Narrative is just tricky. That's just how it is.
It's also something you can bond with the programmers over, because it's documentation, and that's the problem for everybody, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, that's a good point.
There's something specific I want to ask about that, which is you're talking about the like these condensed short summaries that need to be mm-hmm. distributed so everybody's kind of on the same page. How do you balance what the purpose of those are? Because I think There's two ways that I could think to do it, and you let me know if I'm off the rails on this, which is describing sure. like, so, you know, when you're giving it to the art department, like they need mm-hmm. to, you know, they need to come up with what's the wardrobe for this character. So they need to a little mm-hmm. bit with this character's motivations, and so they can get some inspiration and be on the same page with you. So you can be specific to just give them sort of actionable information, not that you're making those choices for them, but that they can then make the choices based on what the choices you've made. Or
right.
you can be much more like, this is what the point of it is. This is the purpose. This is what I want people to take away, a little softer, a little bit more, because sometimes that is more important, I think, like to understand yeah. like why this character is this way or why I'm writing it this way so that this is the mm-hmm. meaning I'm giving to. But that can be really hard to explain mm-hmm. and usually takes a couple more pages.
Yeah.
At least in my yeah. experience. So how do you balance that sort of like, this is a technical document versus this is something to get everybody feeling the story mm. in a way that can inspire them creatively?
Yeah. So yeah, you definitely want to provide as much context as you can to basically point people in the right direction. Yeah. It's kind of what I try to do. So like if I was going to write a character brief, and I actually draw a lot on my theater experience, because a lot of times when you get like a character side or a character brief for an audition, they might give you the bare minimum about this character and mm. they kind of want to see like what your interpretation would be like.
Mm.
So I kind of try to think about like, what are the essential details that are like essential truly to the depiction of this character? Like, you know, like how old are they? Like, what is their ethnicity? What is like their general themes or their general personality? And then especially for stuff like art, what I like to do is kind of be like, yeah, I'm sort of thinking this, and I'll keep it kind of loose. Like I'd be like, okay, so maybe this girly is like, I don't know, like a TikTok e-girl, right? I'd be like, yeah, all right, this is a totally fictitious character. I've never written a TikTok e-girl. That doesn't mean it won't happen one day. But so far,
we'll all be writing that eventually.
But like, so she's a TikTok e-girly, right? Mm. You'd focus on like her outfit and her makeup, and you might be like, okay, so she typically wears this, right? But also based on her personality, I often like to include more likely to do this than that. So like if this girly, if she loves her accessories, she's probably more likely to carry a purse than a backpack, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe she's more likely to wear heels than flats. Like that kind of thing, where it's like, it's not impossible, but it's more likely. And yeah, usually yeah. stuff like that, I feel like helps artists kind of figure out that balance of what this character might be like. And writers also, we absolutely love like turning over character concepts to artists, because like they come back with art and we're just like, it's beautiful. Like, like you could show me a stick figure and be like, I drew your character, and I'd be like, yeah, you nailed it. Like,
yep.
But yeah, pointing people in the right direction is kind of the vibe that I try to go yeah. for, where it's like, here's the space we're kind of operating in. Of course, I want to hear what you have to say. If you have any ideas, like, throw them out. I'm very much a believer in like, everyone has their own expertise. I'm like, yeah. I want to hear it. You know, I want to hear it.
That is an extremely collaborative, like, technique. Mm. That, like, more likely this than that. It's so extrapolatable.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's quite genius, I think. Like, as a
thank you.
I mean, maybe I don't know. Maybe it's just new to me, but like, that idea, being handed something like that, lets me make a lot of creative decisions and not feel imposed upon.
Yeah.
But at the same time, yeah. it's still following the directions.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And like I was sort of saying, like, is it technical or is it sort of inspirational? And you've just described a way to make it both.
That's the goal. It's that third thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like finding that third thing. Yeah. That's what I like to do anyway. Everyone's got their own processes.
But. Right. Yeah, there's no one right way, and that's why, like, you got to sort of it's good to interrogate how other people do things,
because mm-hmm. yeah.
you'll just be like, oh, amazing! I never would have thought to do it that way.
Yeah, and yeah, now I want to draw it.
Yeah,
yeah, for sure. I wrote down extrapolatable because that's also a good word.
It's a good word. Yeah.
Word is a stretch, but
hey, if it's good enough for Chaucer and right. Shakespeare,
yeah,
you know, so you can make up words too.
Exactly, they can mishmash. You can mishmash.
Mm-hmm.
I love the way you said mishmash.
Yeah,
mishmash.
One more time, Ellen.
Mishmash.
Thank you.
I'm curious how many words, this is a real hard question because you have to remember what you've
every
done
single
in the past.
One of the words.
Anyway, yeah, all of the words. No, do you have like a ballpark on like how many words you write for a game? And then like,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, I knew it. It's a kind of hard
That's
question.
So hard. Yeah. Like that would be, it really varies. That's from right. project to project. Like
a range, I guess. Like 20,000 words.
20,000 is like pretty decent. Okay. Like that's like okay. That's pretty chonky, you know, okay. like, like, you know, it really depends on All the right. project. Like some, yeah. if you're having like, of course, like a branching narrative and you have lots of dialogue choices, like your numbers are going to be like really up there.
Yeah.
But if you're writing, you know, a pretty small, like one shot kind of game, it's going to be a lot smaller, you know,
right.
It really is so flexible.
I think that's what feels really daunting about writing for me personally, is it feels like I have to put in a lot of words. And I realize you know, it depends on the size of your, but like, I'm always trying to make, if I'm going to make a game by myself, it's going to be small. Cause I ain't got no time to make a epic. And so like the way I think of it is like, I see like other writers and they're writing a whole bunch of stuff and they have, even if it's just a few branches, it still feels like a lot of writing. And maybe part of it is like, I don't have enough context or to understand the scale. But like I see our narrative designer and I see what she's writing and it's just like, a lot of text. And it's good text. But it's a lot of text. So I think about like when if I wanted to do that, I guess I feel a little bit of pressure on myself to write. I would need to write a bunch. And that was like the worst thing I was when I was in high school.
Oh,
is
no.
whenever they would give me a limit on how many words I'd have to write, I would just make up crap so it would fit within the work.
You missed Chat GPT by 20 years or whatever.
I know.
Oh, gosh. No, I mean, I totally get that. Yeah. I mean, the nice thing about games is that we do have such a space to like freestyle with like, because some of it is also just your individual writing style.
Sure.
Like, yeah. Some people just are more wordy. Others are not as wordy. I can do both depending on the style of the game. You know, like it really varies. I think a lot of people are intimidated by like, they imagine the sheer amount of words that they might have to write to tell a story in a game. But games are more about feeling, in my experience. So like, you can have a game with no words at all and still be incredibly evocative in a storytelling sense, because you've got all these other disciplines. Like you've got lighting, you've got sound. Sound is so huge for storytelling. And so you can tell a story without any dialogue whatsoever in a game, but you know, it's also just kind of down to what are you trying to communicate? Like, is this one character really chatty? In the Foglands, we have one character who's so chatty. Like, she just talks a lot and talks really fast. And, like, that's just her character.
Sure.
You might have a character who's a bit more standoffish. And they might just be like, yes, no, sorry, I'm busy. You know, like, you're going to have... And, like, that tells so much about them with very little words, you know?
Yeah.
Like, so much of it is very flexible.
Sure.
But the biggest thing is, like, I get how narrative can seem intimidating, especially to folks from other disciplines, but, like, we're just messing around and having fun and seeing how things work. And
that's
like,
what we're all doing at the end of the day, right?
Pretty much.
Right? You know, don't be intimidated. Like, just give it a shot. Like,
yeah.
It's fun.
We each have different tools, different little toys we brought into the same sandbox.
Yeah.
Exactly.
There's a fundamental inefficiency to writing, I think.
Okay.
Which is hard to switch over to if you're spend all your time in another discipline.
Sure.
And as someone who bounces around a lot, I think about writing as unique in that way, where you really can, you get your terse character who doesn't say much, you're not necessarily going to spend less time writing that character than the one who's chatty, right? And also the player may not see any of that.
Yeah.
Whereas when you write a great piece of engineering, like that alone is going to provide like so much return to the player in terms of like time spent and experience offered.
Yeah.
And so it's so much more efficient. And even when it comes to art, which is, you know, you could argue one way or the other, but in my experience, a lot of times when you're designing art for games, that efficiency is as important as it is when you're programming.
Mm.
But with writing, you do have to just lean back a little bit. at least in my experience. I think because I'm not professionally disciplined as a writer, mm-hmm. but so it's probably different. Maybe Anna, for you as someone who is you actually have deadlines and milestones and stuff for writing, whereas
yeah.
I usually just do it for fun or on my own projects. Mm-hmm. But I always have to get out of the mindset of like of efficiency.
Yeah. Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Even though that's like a thing that is going to hang over you.
Right.
Yeah. No, that's very true. Writing professionally is a whole other animal compared to like, I just really like to write for fun, you know, mm-hmm. like writing professionally is like, all right, here are the beats we have to hit. We got to do it by Friday. And we're going to, you know, you write this part, you write that character, like go, like yeah. It is, it's very different. I still love it though. I like them both.
Yeah.
I think maybe this is a blessing in disguise, but one of the things that makes writing for interactive media a challenge can also be something that can be beneficial, which is you've got so many other things you can bounce off of, mm. right? So like if you're writing a novel, not that I've ever written a novel, I mean, I've probably tried and went up on Archive of Our Own or whatever, but like it's all in your head, right? And so like if you get stuck, you got to work through it. You know, you can get different inspiration from other places, but like, You are the person who is making the characters do the things and react to things, and you have to create the events that they're going to respond to and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. With, you know, writing for interactive media, especially when you have so many other people that are bringing their own disciplines, like, okay, I have to write to this scene, but what if the player at this point is going to have a choice and they can do this or this? Okay, well, now you have some things you can bounce off of, and mm-hmm. it's not just coming from your own head and your own time, like looking at the screen and just getting words on the page. I have found that a lot easier to deal with when I've had to write, especially like branching scenarios and branching narratives. Yeah. It's like, okay, well, we need to be able to showcase these different scenes. So how do we get there? We just kind of work backwards like a puzzle. And that can be a fun experience, but it's different than just pulling it like agonizingly one little preposition at a time out of your own yeah. meat brain.
I'm hearing a lot of similarities between that and game design. In ways that makes it feel good, because it makes me feel like I could do this.
I'm confident again. Well, listen, okay. Again, camp counselor here, former camp counselor. You can totally do this, okay? Like, I think there's a lot of people out there who feel intimidated by a narrative, and they're like, oh, I've always wanted to try, like, writing for a game. It's like, do it. Go for it. There's yeah. time mm-hmm. for it. Like, just give it a shot. Like, what do you got to lose? Like, just have fun. So I'm glad you're feeling confident. I love hyping other people up. Mm-hmm. You got this.
Thank you.
You can totally do this.
I do got this.
Well, it's a lesson we have to relearn on Nice Games Club from time to time, which is yes. that all things are the same.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Like everything is yeah. super hard.
Yep.
Everything's uh-huh. super harder than you think.
Yeah.
And you can do it all.
Yeah.
If you want to.
If you wanted to. Yeah. You totally could.
It's all within your reach. Mm-hmm. You're not going to have a lot of fun at the beginning. You may yeah, not have fun at the end, but
but you can do it. You That's the important yeah. thing.
We have a perfect podcast.
Yeah. Nothing worth changing?
Nothing worth changing.
Okay.
I mean, a listener hearing that might be like, you know, I've got some thoughts.
Oh. You know,
I mean, not that I believe that.
Right.
It's a perfect podcast.
Uh-huh. Right.
Perfect no notes.
Yes.
But if someone were to hear us say that and just be like completely flabbergasted by our confidence, mm-hmm. how might they express that to us?
Well, I mean, there are many places that could get in touch with us on social, but we have a specific place you can get in touch with us where you don't necessarily have to be like, hi, I'm Ellen B. Johnson, and I think, you know, Steven's mic is too loud. Yeah, well.
That was a note we got. It's a good note.
This is why the podcast is not perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We got that back in the day.
So if you want to let us know that our podcast is perfect, I guess you can go to nicegames.club/feedback and let us know.
Oh, yeah, that's the place. Protect your anonymity.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
But I guess I recognize a lot of the similarities between design and writing in that, like, there's the where you start can be anywhere, I guess, but like you'll have ideas and you kind of have to link things together to get all those ideas to work together.
Right.
In a way that I think is really fascinating. And I hadn't really considered that with respect to writing. I think whenever I think of writing, I think of school and I'm like, I have an objective. I need to write this essay. And like, cause I didn't really do a lot of creative writing, when I was going to school. But now that I have the opportunity to do that, I guess I still kind of think of writing in that way, or at least when I want to write, that's how I think of it, is like, I have an objective and this is how I need to write it. So I will just write this and maybe add some fluff to make it sound kind of fun. because it's not,
you kind of got it.
Yeah. Okay. I guess I'm a writer then.
Well, it's usually we have, like, we call them beats, like story beats.
Story beats.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here's our objective. And like, you want to hit all of those notes, but you also want to say something, you know, with your themes and your, So
it is a little bit
like that. Like you said, you know,
That's just fascinating. Everything is the same as everything else. I learned that lesson every like 3 days. It's great.
Well, it's, you know, as when you're doing game design, you're trying to impart meaning through interactivity, right?
Right.
And narrative is meaning through story, and I mean, it's other things. But one of the challenges both disciplines share is handing that moment over to the player. So that's why games that try to be movies tend to like have this real struggle between like scenes that are important to the story being in, like, buried in a cutscene where you're just watching it, versus scenes that are really important being something where you're like, you know, shooting a bunch of dudes with an AK-47 on a rooftop, and it doesn't feel like story anymore.
Right.
But like, it's an important moment in the plot, because that struggle is so difficult. But so, Anna, as a writer, like, very specific, like, you want characters to say things to each other, but then sometimes you need to hand that moment, that important pivot in the plot, that twist, that conclusion, that transition to a new beat, that you're handing that to the player, and they might just be running around in the overworld or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, or maybe the best you can do, because you have limited tools sometimes to deliver, like, words, sometimes. And writing isn't always just that. But how do you face that struggle? Because game designers have the same problem, which is like, we're trying to impart a meaning, but it's up to the player to build it.
Right.
Right? And so with writing, it's actually much more of a technical challenge, really, of like, you know, how do you make sure they hear what the character says in that moment? They don't have the camera pointed in the wrong direction because you're not in a cutscene, you know?
Yeah. No, that's a huge challenge, honestly, especially in VR, right? Yeah. Where the players, like, the players literally could just be like chilling in the same room, not looking, not paying attention, you know, that kind of thing. That's when things get really tricky. Because you need to find a way to keep the player engaged. A really good example of this is in Half-Life Alyx. Actually, there's a cutscene where you're like planning out your route of attack with your, well, it's not really an attack, but you're planning out a route with your companion character. And they're like, oh, okay, let's look at this. Grab something to represent us and set it on the map. So like the player, or the NPC is literally like, I want you to do this thing to like help us progress the story moment. So you can like go and like maybe pick up a cup or whatever and put it down on the map. And then he's like, okay. And then grab something to represent like someone else. And then you might go do that. And then they're like, okay. So here's where we are. And like the NPC might literally move things around on the map and it's the items that the player has chosen.
Yeah.
So literally finding those granular moments of like keeping the player involved is really, really essential in, especially when like you don't have cutscenes really in like VR.
Yeah.
There's a real danger of relying too much on cutscenes. My sibling one time had an anecdote about like, sometimes games feel like you read a chapter of a book, you throw the book across the room, you get up, you go walk over to the book, you pick the book up, you go back to your chair, you sit down, and then you read the next chapter.
Yeah.
I've always thought that was the like the most brilliant explanation of really that. Like, yeah. I'm like, dang, they nailed it.
Yeah.
So like trying to avoid that is really tricky. And you constantly just have to think of ways, little tiny granular ways to keep the player involved.
Yeah. And those things can be expressed. I mean, that's everyone needs to share in that, right? That's some game design, like the Half-Life Alyx example. There's some game design involved. There's some engineering involved just to make that work. But it's fundamentally a story point.
Yeah.
And I think Dale and I just played through Star Trek Resurgence, which is a Telltale style game. Mm-hmm. And one of the things it does is it gives you tons of interactive moments that don't matter at all, but just keep your hands on the controller.
Yeah.
In a way that, like, I think a lot of gamers will look at that and be like, nah, that's lazy. But like, actually, that I think that's very smart from a narrative perspective.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite ones is you have like a self-destruct code late in the game, because
of course.
And it asks you to, you know, you ever see like Picard code Alpha Tango 3-7 or something, right? Like that's a little bit of world building they do on the show. You get to choose what those words are. And then and then later in the game, it comes up again and the your character just says it. And even though that's in the middle of a cutscene, you got to choose that.
Yeah.
Arbitrary, does not matter at all, has no impact on the narrative whatsoever, but like a really, really strong narrative component that is interactive and involves the player.
Yeah. Point of connection.
In a game that is otherwise just a bunch of cutscenes with button prompts. Right? Yeah. Like that can still be innovative and interesting, right?
Yeah.
I love that concept. Like that wouldn't, like I'm even thinking like that wouldn't even be hard to set up. Like that's not hard to set up at all from a design standpoint. Like that's like cheap pretty much, but like it's still so validating to the player that like a choice that I made is now happening, even though it's small, you know.
Yeah.
That's very satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those cheap wins, like it feels like cheating sometimes, but like it's the disconnect between what matters and what's hard to build and what the players take away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's no one-to-one correlation whatsoever. Right?
Yep.
Like one of the hardest things to make in games is a save data system.
Oh my gosh.
Players don't care.
Honestly.
Right.
Like they just expect it to work.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Like they're not going to appreciate the extra love and care you put into that, you know, to make sure that the files don't get corrupted.
Yeah.
But that's still going to take a lot of your time.
Yeah.
And it's true across disciplines.
Yeah. Or item persistence.
Yeah.
Oh my God. You go from one map to another. Like, I don't know a lot about engineering. I'm a writer, but like over the many projects that I have been in, item persistence is hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, just an example that you cited earlier that fits into this is that your chatty character, like the player needs to understand that they're chatty, but the only way to do that is to write a lot of dialogue, maybe not all of it that they will see.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a ton of effort for a small expression. And whereas in a movie, you could do that by someone just talking fast and the character running by them.
Right.
You could quickly communicate that concept with a lot less work than you can in an interactive medium. But you can communicate something equally important to the player much simpler in other scenarios, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Steven's got his thinking hat on.
I am. I'm thinking. I'm like, what should I write next? What tools do you use to organize your thoughts and your writing?
Yes.
Because it's all new to me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not
Notepad primarily.
Yeah, probably that. Yeah.
Yeah. So this really varies from writer to writer, and studio to studio when it comes literally to tools. So I am, big fan of ye olde Google Drive. I love it. It's great. I love that multiple people can work on at the same time. I feel like my producer would frown at me if I didn't mention Confluence. We love keeping documentation on there. But also some people use additional programs. Like there's one called Scrivener that people use that allows them to keep track of a bunch of their notes and the actual document itself. Some people really like those. So those are tools for keeping thoughts organized that people sometimes use. When it comes to actually writing the game, a lot of, especially big studios, will have proprietary software. So because there really isn't any sort of industry standard when it comes to actual tools that you work in to make narrative. Like a lot of times it's in-house built.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of tools on the market that people can use, like Ink or like Godot or Artisy Draft. You know, there's those kinds of things. But a lot of the time it is really unique to the project with what you use.
Yeah.
So when you come onto a project as a writer, you're kind of just like, all right, what are we working with here? And you like, you figure it out, you know, you just figure it out.
That's cool. I mean, I appreciate that. Like Google Drive is a good one to stick with. Right. It always
does the job.
A lot of options, frankly. So it makes
sense.
Yeah. Sometimes we talk about constraints being valuable, but sometimes no.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like sometimes just a blank page is kind of what you need because you're sort of building the system. You don't always need to prototype it, right?
Yes.
But for that Ink, Twine, they're available.
Right.
But yeah, every project is different, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That must be scary a little bit. I mean, I guess you're used to it now. But like, it must be a little bit like, okay, this worked really well in the last project, but like, I don't know what the next project's going to in store for me. Because you have to, you have to do a lot of learning, and that's time you could have spent, if there was things were more standardized, it's time you could have spent working, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely more scary when you're first starting out, because you have to learn all of these things just to kind of get up to speed with people currently working in the industry. The good thing is that a lot of the tools that are like in-house built or maybe even some of the out-of-the-box ones like Artisy Draft, a lot of them have a lot of similarities. And as long as you know like what you do really well, like, okay, I know how to set up like logic and variables, no problem. You just have to figure out how to do it in that unique program.
Right.
So like as long as you know your stuff, you can kind of figure it out in pretty much any program. And they're all, it's kind of like, you know, if you know one game engine, it's kind of easier to learn another game engine because you know, like the functionalities that should exist in there. It's just, you don't know how to get there in that specific program or like what keystroke or like whatever. So, it definitely gets easier as you go along. I honestly don't mind the continuous learning aspect, because like I often sometimes am inspired by story moments, by what the particular tool can do. Like, oh, it's really cool that we can do this thing where like maybe in your tool, you can have player characters interrupt each other. That's actually a really hard thing to set up. You can have characters interrupt each other. And it's like, okay, what if we have two characters that hate each other and they keep interrupting each other because they're tired of hearing the other one talk? Like I would get inspired by the literal functionality of the tools. So I personally don't mind. I mean, I can't speak for all writers. I'm sure there are some who find it really annoying, but I don't mind. It's fun.
I'm glad you brought up inspiration because that was going to be my next question. Where you get your inspiration from? It sounds like you get your inspiration from your tool set, which is great.
Yeah.
But are there other avenues that you found helpful to keep writing when you need to?
So a lot of this is going to, of course, vary from writer to writer. I am one of those writers where I could literally pull inspiration from like anything. A lot of people like to find, you know, another comparable game or maybe a movie. Like movies are really popular comparisons for better or worse. But I love to be like, all right, so like a lot of times I'll be like, so my inspiration was this one Philip Glass opera, and everyone's like, oh, okay. And I'll be like, and then there's this painting by Sargent that I really like, and I like this painting. And I'm also really inspired by this one natural phenomena I stayed up really late reading Wikipedia articles on. And like, so I like to pull all sorts of things that from all sorts of areas of life, because when you're a writer, I think you kind of just want to know everything about everything. And there's so many cool things in the world. You could live a million lifetimes and still not know everything. Yeah. So I look to all kinds of art mediums. I look to the natural world. I look to science. I look to history, you know, why not? I think that's really, I think that's a really fun way to create a game with a unique feeling too. At least in my experience.
Yeah, I think games do need more of that, right? Like, it's partly because they are such logistical challenges. It can be hard to... And this is not the same as, like, games are boring or novelty is good or anything.
Yeah.
But like, I think you're describing a really like robust inspiration process for a writer in any medium. But it does seem like it's maybe a little harder to keep that alive as a games writer. Is that accurate?
It can be tricky. Sort of alongside of my previous answers, like communicating what those inspirations are to people can be really helpful.
Yeah.
And when you pull from a wide variety of sources, I find that like some might really click with some people based on what their particular background is. Like if I said, oh, I've got this painting that really inspires me because of like the light and stuff like that. Like an artist on the team might be like, oh, I totally get it. You know, like just because people approach things through their own experience. So I find if you find a variety of things and you communicate that to the rest of the team, it can actually be really helpful to help people see what you're thinking about and like what you are really focusing in on. Retaining that can be really tricky across like, you know, the entire duration of a project. That's a really long time.
Yeah.
But finding ways to continuously sort of sew those into your narrative moments and all of your other elements within the story, I think you can make it work. But like you said, it's a logistical challenge. It definitely is.
But you can do it.
Ellen's pointing to Steven right now.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I feel like I need to process everything and then like ask you a bunch of questions again.
Yeah, can you just stick around for a couple of days and so
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, sure. I'll be all week.
Oh man. Yeah, no, that's really helpful. Lots of good ideas that are like super timely for what I'm working with right now.
Yay.
Very happy that you came on the show here this July 17th, 2023. Gave us this guidance. One moment in history.
Narrative design history.
Yeah, exactly. Pivot. Well, we'll see what I can do with it. But yeah. Super helpful, I think, for narrative designers and writers of all stripes,
yeah,
sorts and experience.
Well, one of the things we say on the show is like, if you're interested, just start doing it. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a big theme today.
Yeah.
But maybe let's end with if you have any more advice on someone who is either they've never made any game before, or they've made a ton of games and they want to try out narrative. How do they start? What are the practical and impractical, or practical and broadly sort of generalized advice on like, what's the first step?
Yeah. There are, you know, there's actually many first steps in that no one really comes into game narrative with a like typical background. Mm-hmm. Like people ask like, oh, well, how do you get into that? And it's like, well, we just kind of end up here. It's kind of the answer. Like I know there's so many narrative designers.
So if you're lost, you're already in good shape.
Yeah.
Congratulations. You've already mastered the first moment of like your narrative design career. So like usually you're right. The first thing is just start doing it. So usually what I would recommend to people if they're really interested in learning how to do game writing is make something really small. And I do mean really small. Like maybe it's a like single kind of event thing. There's lots of free programs out there. There's Twine, there's Bitsy, and there's also like forums associated with those if you want to find out how to do like a particular thing. Maybe you want you're doing like a Little Red Riding Hood game and you're trying to take the basket of food to your grandma and you'd be like, oh, I have to do an item transfer. Like, how do I do that in variables in Twine? You know, there's people who can tell you how to do that on the forums. Making something small for yourself and completing it is huge. Not just in a game's perspective, because making something and shipping it is like, it sounds simple, really hard, right? Yeah. But it also allows you to go through the process of it. Cause like the joy of writing and narrative design is in the process, right? That's why we do it. We love doing it. So when you make something really small, you're able to learn the process of it and go, okay, maybe, I need to learn more about doing this next time. Or like, what could I have done different next time? Make little things like that and continually, experiment. You can also work on like building a portfolio of writing samples. And that's like a whole, I could give like a whole GDC talk on like building a portfolio because there's like a huge art to it. But just start like, you know, writing things that you'd want to include in a portfolio, like maybe some barks or a short scene in like a screenplay format, building all that together. Just practice, like writing. A lot of writing is like just practicing. My dad was a professional journalist and he always used to say that the hardest part of writing is just keeping your butt in the chair. And that's very true. so just practice, just, you're, and also because I know this is also a PSA for us all of us game people, because I know we like to be very perfectionistic in our work. You're not going to be perfect at it at first. That's normal. Okay. Like, that's all right. Expect things to like not work great. You got to stick with it. Give yourself grace. It's really hard. And of course, like networking with other game writers. If you're interested in like a certain person's work, reach out to them about it. A lot of game writers, we do like mentorships with other like upcoming writers. The community is actually really friendly. We're all just kind of goofy people and we love helping out others. So, you know, like get to know who has the sort of jobs that you might want to have one day and ask them, you know, about their experience or if they say they do portfolio reviews, like just go for it. It's scary, but you can do it. That's the message. Yeah. So like, that's typically what I try to tell people is like, you can do this. It's just, it takes time. It takes practice. And sometimes that means talking to people. But you can do it. And, you know, there's a room for all of us at the table. It's a really big table. It keeps getting bigger every day and we keep making more chairs. So pull one on up, baby.
It's a good metaphor. Yeah. So good.
I mean,
I'm like, I'm not surprised, but like,
A, brilliant advice. B, I can hear the camp counselor coming back.
Yeah. I know.
It's, you know, it's what people need in this time.
Yeah.
Yes. Agreed.
Yes. It's, yeah, I think it's a good vibe to have, especially in like an industry that is so, you know, high strung, shall we say, as games, where everyone's so pressed for time and so stressed out. Like sometimes you gotta be like, you're doing your best, my dude. I'm proud of you. You know? Yeah. Absolutely.
So where can people go for more camp counselor vibes?
Yes. Oh my gosh, totally. you can totally find me on socials. My handle like on Twitter and stuff is Anna C. Webbs. You can find me there. I also, one of my like narrative design loves is actually horror games. I love horror game narrative particularly. So I have
what
a Substack called Resident Anna.
Horror games. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just...
Huh?
What is it with narrative designers and horror games? I don't get it. It's not just you.
We love horror games.
I don't understand. It's fine.
I love it. I love them. But yes, you can check out... My Substack is called Resident Anna, where I talk about narrative design and psychology and everything of horror game narrative specifically. Mm. And you can totally check out our upcoming game, The Foglands. You can find it on the PlayStation Store. You can wishlist it, follow us on socials, all that sort of stuff. That's the plug.
Yeah, we didn't spend a lot of time talking about that game, but it is very, very unique. I think people really should check it out. Mm-hmm. Even if it doesn't sound like, oh, I might not be interested in that, like, you will be interested in it. It's very interesting.
We're so proud of it, honestly. Like, the people who are, like, part of the really core team of Well Told who've been there since the company was founded, this is, like, their baby. They've, aww, like, looked at this concept for so many years, mm-hmm, and I'm so delighted to have gotten to collaborate on this. The other writer I've worked with on this project, Madeline Daniels, is brilliant. And like, we're so excited for people to experience our story. So check it out. It's cool. There's cowboys. What more could you want?
That's great. Well, thank you so much. I am like legit gonna do writing during a game jam or something because I'm like inspired.
Yeah,
this is good.
I'll do the joke programming and you do the writing.
Yes, let's do it.
Air five.
Table, well, that would be fun.
You did.
I better learn some Godot real fast. Okay.
I've written before, so I'm okay.
Okay. That's our show. For show notes and links on today's discussion, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on Twitter and Mastodon at Nice Games Club, where Dale tweets and toots about game dev resources and programmable keys. We like hearing from you, so please tweet and toot back, or email us, contact@nicegames.club. We are on Patreon. You can support the show, and you can get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be looking at cheating again. But that's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.